Welcome to Music in Time on WGXC, the show where we put albums in their historical context. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, historian by day, music lover by night, bringing those two worlds together on this little sonic time travel trip. I've got an amazing show for you today. We're going to be heading back to New York City, January 1989, when the Big Apple's unofficial poet laureate, Lou Reed, released the album New York. We're going to be examining the historical context for the album, the city at that moment, and the question that seems to run through the album and through so much of Lou Reed's work, whether New York was something exceptional or the beating heart of the United States. We'll be playing some tracks from the album, looking to other moments when New York City mattered beyond the five boroughs. I've also got two great interviews today, one with Bill Bentley, a longtime publicist for Lou Reed at Warner Brothers, and with Heather Lember, an archivist at the New York Public Library who processed Lou Reed's archival collection, now the subject of an exhibit at the NYPL. All that and more on this episode of Music in Time. It's January 10th, 1989, and in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Arms Hotel is under siege. It's a sit-in. About 100 people or so are camped out in the lobby, with more protesting outside. But this isn't a typical lobby, and it's not your typical hotel. Now, it had been at one point. The Brooklyn Arms opened in 1927 as the Granada, a residential hotel in downtown Brooklyn. But by 1989, it was a different kind of hotel, a welfare hotel. Beginning in the 1970s, facing an acute shortage of public housing, the city had begun renting rooms from property owners to use as emergency housing for families in need. These so-called welfare hotels, about 60 across the city, had become a controversial fixture of the city's emergency housing program. The Brooklyn Arms was the city's second largest. Despite the relatively high cost, very few resources had gone into the upkeep of the hotels. And throughout the 1980s, most New Yorkers came to see them as broken-down facilities, ones where drug abuse and crime had become rampant. But of course, they were also homes. In 1986, after a fire had killed four children at the Brooklyn Arms, a group of mothers organized into a group called Parents on the Move, which lobbied for issues with the facilities like fixing lights and maintaining water service. But the group also lobbied to protect the Brooklyn Arms Hotel from nearby real estate development. Well, in the 1980s, the welfare hotels became a cultural flashpoint beyond New York City. After reading an editorial that cited the rent of a welfare hotel room at $37,000 a year, President Ronald Reagan called out the program as inefficient, an example to Reagan of wasteful social spending by government agencies. After the Reagan administration threatened to pull $70 million in federal aid to the city for such emergency programs, New York Mayor Ed Koch announced plans to close all of the welfare hotels, including the Brooklyn Arms, which the city announced in January of 1989 would close by July. And that's when residents launched their protest in the lobby of the Brooklyn Arms. Many of the residents were themselves critical of the hotels, but on the other hand, they didn't trust city officials to uproot their families' lives and move them to habitable facilities. And it didn't help when the city called in the police to break up the protest. Christopher Jackson, an assemblyman for the district that included Fort Greene, told the Daily News, "It's chilling to think that a city would send in a paramilitary force to deal with a social service problem." As chance would have it, on that very day, January 10th, 1989, a new album by Lou Reed hit record store shelves. It was called simply New York. And one of the singles off that record, Dirty Boulevard, spun a tale that revolved around a welfare hotel, the Wilshire, this one on West 58th Street in Manhattan, but which seemed to capture everything at stake in the lobby of the Brooklyn Arms.
Pedro lives out of the Wilshire Hotel. He looks out a window without glass. The walls are made of cardboard. Newspapers on his feet, and his father beats him because he's too tired to beg. He's got nine brothers and sisters. They're brought up on their knees. It's hard to run when a coat hanger beats you on the thighs. Pedro dreams of being older and killing the old man, but that's a slim chance. He's going to the boulevard. He's gonna end up on the dirty boulevard. He's going out to the dirty boulevard. He's going down to the dirty boulevard. This room costs $2,000 a month. You can believe it, man, it's true. Somewhere a landlord's laughing till he wets his pants. No one dreams of being a doctor or a lawyer or anything. They dream of dealing on the dirty boulevard. Give me your hungry, you're tired, you're poor, I'll piss on them. That's what the statue of bigotry says. Your poor huddled masses, let's club them to death and get it over with and just dump them on the boulevard. Get them out on the dirty boulevard. Going out to the dirty boulevard. They're going down on the dirty boulevard. Going out. Outside, it's a bright night. There's an opera at Lincoln Center. Movie stars arrive by limousine. The Klieg lights shoot up over the skyline of Manhattan, but the lights are out on the mean streets. A small kid stands by the Lincoln Tunnel. He's selling plastic roses for a buck. The traffic's backed up to 39th Street. The TV whores are calling the cops out for a suck. And back at the wheelchair, Pedro sits there dreaming. He's found a book on magic in a garbage can. He looks at the pictures and stares up at the cracked ceiling. At the count of three, he says, I hope I can disappear and fly, fly away from this dirty boulevard. I want to fly, yeah, from the dirty boulevard. I want to fly from the dirty boulevard. I want to fly, 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 fly from the dirty boulevard. I want to fly away. I want to fly. Fly, fly away, yeah. I wanna fly. Fly, fly away.
Fly, fly, fly away.
Fly, fly, fly,
fly, fly, fly away.
Fly, fly away, yeah.
You're listening to Music and Time on WGXC. This is your host, Evan McCormick. That was Dirty Boulevard off of Lou Reed's 1989 album New York, which we're talking about today. Now, I don't think you need me to tell you that Lou Reed and the city of New York were intimately connected. Born on Long Island, raised in Brooklyn, Lou Reed's entire career had been wrapped up in the Big Apple. In the 1960s, as part of the Velvet Underground, Lou had risen to prominence around Andy Warhol and his factory scene. In his songs, Reed, who had always thought of himself as a writer as much as a musician, had found a way to capture the city's dramatic vibrancy, its hidden characters, its sexual and drug-hazed underground, in Velvet songs like Run, Run, Run and Waiting for the Man. And after leaving the Velvets in 1970, Lou continued to explore the dark corners of New York City, most famously perhaps in Walk on the Wild Side, but in albums like Street Hassle and Coney Island Baby as well. Not for nothing is Reed, who died in 2013, remembered as the unofficial poet laureate of the city. So there was something natural about Reed recording an album, an opus, about the city in 1989. An album which launched something of a creative rebirth for him. Critics thought so too. This album was one of the most acclaimed of Reed's long career. But this is Music and Time, after all. And so what I want to say to you is that New York, just like Lou Reed, was changing through all those years. And the New York that Reed was addressing at this particular moment in 1989 was riven by social problems that had been wrought during the 1980s. Foremost among them was poverty. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 1988, one of every four New York City residents was living below the U.S. poverty line, and 37% of children in the city were under the poverty line, a number that had jumped more than 10% in the previous 10 years, and which included a disproportionate number of African Americans, Hispanics, and recent immigrants. Drug abuse was also rampant in the city, which was in the midst of the so-called crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s. In the 2 years before 1989, hospitalizations related to crack cocaine had jumped more than 125%. The homicide rate also rose 10% during that time, with many of those crimes connected to drugs, giving way to a cultural panic over a drug-fueled crime wave. There was also the public health dimension. Hospitalizations related to AIDS and psychiatric disorders were also rising at alarming rates, leading to an acute shortage of bed space at the city's public and private hospitals. Amidst all this, the city witnessed tensions between the police and city residents as law enforcement took on an increasing role in addressing issues like homelessness, squatting, and drug abuse. Lou Reed's New York took on all of these social issues, not in a heavy-handed, pedantic way, but in Reed's typical literary fashion. Over the foundation laid by Reed's sparse but defiant guitar playing, his talk-singing baritone weaves stories that depict a city backed into a corner, beaten down, with the haves and have-nots eyeing each other warily. New York is ultimately an album about class, created by the politics of the 1980s. You see, whereas New York City, like many cities, had long modeled how to tackle social problems, free market Reaganomics of the 1980s had battered the city's ability to do that. The Reagan administration cut federal contributions to state and city programs that helped the poor in New York City, by one estimation, by about $1 billion a year. Food stamps and welfare programs, when adjusted for inflation at the end of the 1980s, weren't enough to bring needy families above the poverty line. As federal aid began to dry up, the city was forced to make tough choices between spending on social programs and other administrative priorities like parks and traffic, etc. It all led to the sense that the city was going down the drain. Reed seemed to understand that beyond the problems themselves, what was threatening New York City was the idea that people were being left behind, not just economically and socially, but in the sense that they were powerless to do anything about it. The greed is good capitalism of the 1980s, which, after all, was honed on Wall Street, had created a powerful sense that those on the fringes of society deserved to be there and that there was little to be done for them. In late 1988, the city's human resources administrator, Bill Grinker, told the New York Times, "The city's safety net is not only frayed, but there are holes in it and people are falling through." Unlike some of his other albums and songs that invited listeners to peer into the dark corners of the city, almost like voyeurs, and experience something exotic that they couldn't otherwise imagine, on the album New York, Reed seems to be doing something different, inviting listeners to see the city as a mirror for the problems facing the country at large. I did an interview with Bill Bentley, Lou's longtime publicist for Warner Brothers, when the album New York came out, who saw firsthand this connection that Lou Reed had with the city. Almost like an old friend coming to counsel it, he says. I've got that interview coming up for you, but first, it's Romeo Had Juliet, the album's opening track and one which captures all of the human drama that Reed saw on the city streets.
Caught between the twisted stars, the plotted lines, the faulty map that brought Columbus to New York. Betwixt between the east and west, he calls on her wearing a leather vest. The earth squeals and shudders to a halt. A diamond crucifix in his ear is used to help ward off the fear that he has left his soul in someone's rented car. Inside his pants he hides a mop to clean the mess that he has dropped into the life of lightsome Juliet Bell. And Romeo wanted Juliet, and Juliet wanted Romeo, and Romeo wanted Juliet, and Juliet wanted Romeo. Romeo Rodriguez squares his shoulders and curses Jesus, runs a comb through his black ponytail. He's thinking of his lonely room, the sink that by his bed gives off a stink, then smells her perfume in his eyes, and her voice was like a bell. Outside Outside, the streets were steaming. The crack dealers were dreaming of a Uzi somewhere near to scored. I bet you I can hit that light with my one good arm behind my back, says little Joey Diaz. Brother, give me another tote. Those downtown hoods are no damn good. Those Italians need a lesson to be taught. This cop who died in Harlem, you think they get the warning? I was dancing when I saw his brains run out on the street. And Romeo had Juliet, and Juliet had her Romeo, and Romeo had Juliet, and Juliet had a Romeo. I'll take Manhattan in a garbage bag with Latin written on it that says it's hard to give a shit these days. Manhattan sinking like a rock until the filthy Hudson, what a shock. They wrote a book about it, they said it was like ancient Rome. The perfume burned his eyes, holding tightly to her thighs, and something flickered for a minute, and then it vanished and was gone.
You're listening to Music in Time on WGXC, and today I'm joined by Bill Bentley. Bill Bentley has had a long career in and around the music industry as a writer, a musician, a producer, a publicist, and an executive, but above all, I think a music lover and one who has lived a lot of music history, from Texas, where he got his start, to Los Angeles, and many places in between. We're talking to him today because from 1986 to 2006, he was Senior Vice President of Warner Brother Records, where, among other things, he got to know Lou Reed, both as a musician on the label and a friend. Bill, thanks for joining us today to talk a little bit about Lou Reed on Music in Time.
My pleasure.
So, speaking of time, we're talking about New York Today, an album that came out in early 1989. And I understand you came to know Lou Reed right around that time. So how did that come to pass?
Well, I've been at Warner's since 1986, and I'd kind of worked my way from one department into publicity. And then when I got into publicity in mid-88, one of the first records I was assigned to start working on was going to be Lou Reed's debut on Sire Records called New York. You know, he'd been on RCA, been on Arista, and of course the Velvets were on different labels, but he was coming to Sire, and it was just such an exciting time for me because I was, for the people at Warner Brothers, you know, I was Lou's guy. I knew so much about him. I loved his music, and I just couldn't wait to meet him and start working with him on New York. And at that point, Sylvia Reed, his wife, and who was then managing Lou, sent me an advance cassette of the album New York, and it was beyond anything I was expecting. It was easily one of Lou's best albums, but it was just so pertinent and timely and everything that, you know, when you work with an artist as a publicist, you can only do as good a job as the music is. I mean, you're not really able to do the work you want to do unless the record's great. And this record was so great. I just knew we were going to have a great run with it. And I felt at that very time I first heard it, it was going to bring Lou Reed back into the public consciousness in a way that he deserved to be.
That's an important point. You had been a Lou Reed fan all your life, I know, some from reading some of your writing. And what really struck you about what he was trying to do with that album? What did you hear in that advanced copy of New York relative to some of the work he had done prior to that?
Well, with Lou, you know, I've always felt like there were certain albums that had three or four great songs on it, and then other good songs, but this record, I think there was, I forget now, it might have been 10, 11 songs. Every song was gigantic to me. I mean, from the start to the end. And he was addressing what the 1980s had done to New York. I mean, it kind of like decimated it in terms of assistance programs and things like that, where New York was kind of back in the doldrums again, much like it had been in the mid-70s, and it was starting to sort of decay in the late 80s. And I felt like Lou loved New York probably, you know, as much as any human he ever loved. He actually really loved the city like a living thing. And you could hear it in his songs that he was just upset about what was happening. I mean, from Dirty Boulevard, just that song alone, through Halloween Parade and all these other songs, it just, I think he was talking to New York like it had been a best friend, and now he was worried about its health. I think only Lou Reed could have written the album New York. Nobody before or since could have ever recorded and made a record like that.
And you were based in Los Angeles at the time, is that right?
Yeah, Lois, after I moved to Los Angeles from Austin in 1980, when I moved from Austin to Los Angeles in 1980, I never lived anywhere else. I visited New York a lot, especially when I started working for Warner Brothers. But yeah, I've always been based in LA.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask what it was like to get to know Lou Reed personally at that time. You had known him through music, but as you started to work with him, how'd you see that connection to the city and you know, when you got to know him, when you would come east to you know, get work done around the publicity for the record?
Well, it was really, to me, getting to know Lou Reed at that point, 1988 and 89, it was kind of like a dream come true, but it started on a little bit of a rocky note, and I'll tell you why. It was really kind of my fault. When I got the cassette for the Advance of New York, I wrote Lou a letter saying, you know, just how amazing I felt the album was, how I really looked forward to being his publicist. And then my mistake was, I mentioned in the letter that in Austin in the 1970s, I'd gotten to be friends with Sterling Morrison, who was Lou's bandmate in the Velvet Underground. Sterling had moved to Austin to get his PhD at University of Texas, and then I had met him and recruited him to join our band, the Bizarros, where he played guitar with us for 4 or 5 years. So yeah, I got to be very close friends with Sterling, so I put that in the letter to Lou, saying that I was lucky that I'd been friends with Sterling, because he had told me a lot about the Velvet Underground and how all that came to be. So I fly over to New York in the, I think it was November of 88, to meet with Lou. We were going to record an interview for a promotional disc we were putting together, where I was going to pick one song from every Lou Reed and Velvet Underground album. Then we're going to make a CD box that we could send out to the press, including my interview. So I go to the studio, never met Lou Reed, hadn't even talked to him on the phone. I'd just written him a letter. And I go in the studio, and he's waiting for me, right? And he just looks at me, doesn't say hello, and said, come with me. And I'd heard from some different people at Warner Brothers that he could be pretty tough to handle. You know, I didn't have any preconceptions about I was going to be his friend, you know, but I was hoping it would be a very cordial relationship. So he says, come with me. And I thought, like, oh no, now what? And we go in this little room in the studio, and he looked at me. He didn't say hello. He didn't even introduce himself. He knew I was. I knew he was. And he said, look, let's get one thing straight. Sterling Morrison remembers everything about the Velvet Underground, and I remember nothing. Do you got it? And I said, I got it, which was his way of telling me that he did not want to spend any time talking about the Velvet Underground. Lou was very proud of what he did in the Velvet Underground, but Lou was all about what he was doing now. And he was a true artist in that way. It wasn't about his past accomplishments. It's about what the present had. And, you know, I got what he was saying, and I realized I'd kind of made a mistake bringing up the fact that I'd been friends with Sterling. And then we did this, like, hour-long interview, and really and truly, it's like we clicked and we just became very good friends that evening, and it stayed that way forever. I mean, I worked with him and was friends with him for the next 25 years until he died, and he never had a short word with me or anything. It was just a very, very, very good relationship, and I'm not saying I'm special, but I count myself among the very lucky that we never hit a roadblock. Because by the end of his relationship with Warner Brothers, he really was hardly speaking to anybody at the label. He kind of felt like they'd just gone on to other things, and some of the records he put out on the label didn't get much attention. And, you know, Lou told me something very interesting once. It was kind of heartbreaking. He said, you know, when you watch one of your albums fail, it's like watching someone murder one of your children. And I think he told me that after The Raven.
Wow.
Yeah. That hurt.
Yeah. You know, the way you talked about that document of the city, it makes me want to ask about how he planned to take it out on the road and the experience of playing shows around that album. Do you have any memories or memorable gigs that stick out in your mind from that tour in 1989?
I have so many memorable gigs. I mean, he started touring, I believe it was around the summer of 89. The record came out in January of 89. Lou told me he liked to put out records in January because there weren't many other records out to compete with it. He's very smart about his career. You know, been doing it since he was like 15 years old. But so when he decided to tour, the first thing he decided to do, they rented a small theater just off Broadway, you know, where they normally had plays, the St. James. And he played there, I think, three or four nights, which really brought the New York cream of the crop of the press and celebrities and things out to see Lou at a place on Broadway, you know, like a theater. And that just started the whole tone of New York as being, as Lou said, it was kind of like a movie, but with songs. He insisted on playing the whole album in its entirety on stage, and then he would come back and do other songs from his past career. But he presented it like it was a play about New York in the present days. I mean, almost every song on it referred to what was going on in New York then. You know, the beginning of a new adventure, definitely Halloween Parade, Romeo and Juliet. All those songs were just almost written out of the headlines of what was going on. And then as he went around the country, he did that on almost every show. It was the New York album and then a set of other Lou Reed songs. And it made people listen to that album, I think, in a very serious manner that they didn't always do for new albums. You know, usually when you go to a rock show, I'd say 80% of the audience normally wants to hear the old songs. And the artist knows that. It makes them uptight, but they know that's what they come for, so they kind of have to do that most of the time. But Lou didn't. Lou was very uncompromising. When he felt like he wanted to do something, he did it, and then just let the chips fall where they may. But I think with a record as good as New York, I don't remember any backlash of people going like, well, why is he playing the whole album? They really enjoyed it and respected it because Lou Reed fans are a little different than the normal rock audience. They kind of have a seriousness about how they listen to music, I think. You know, Lou coming so much out of literature, I mean, he was an English major in college, and as he once said, you know, he started writing rock and roll songs like the Velvet Underground's because he said you could read about certain things in books and see it portrayed in movies, but people didn't take rock and roll songs serious enough to use that kind of subject matter in their songs, and he wanted to change that, and he did. You know, over the course of the Velvet's career, all the things that had been kind of taboo in rock and roll, like, you know, like say out of books by William Burroughs or Nelson Algren or some of Lou's favorite mystery writers like Dashiell Hammett. He loved Raymond Chandler. In fact, his pseudonym when he checked into a hotel when he was on tour was Ray Chandler. And when he started writing songs at the very start of the Velvets, you know, they were all sort of taking what was in literature and put it into rock and roll. And I think that's one of the main things that Lou Reed accomplished over his career was just that. He made rock and roll broader in what it could be about. He kept expanding it throughout until, you know, the last few albums. I mean, you look at The Raven, which was based on the works of Edgar Allan Poe. Who had ever done that?
And it's nowhere is that more clear than New York, which is, like you said, you know, a play, perhaps a dramatic piece, or I think of a novel of the city. As I was looking back at shows from that time, you know, I noticed that he played Letterman twice, and I thought that was strange. So I went and watched them. Of course, in May, he played Letterman, but it was Letterman in Chicago. And, you know, it's almost like he's taking New York, this play, this dramatic representation on the road. It's such a, he plays Busload of Faith. It's an incredible, incredible yes. performance. Yeah.
I'll never forget. There's a real memory I have. I believe it was for the New York album. It might've been later, but we did Letterman and, you know, you come out, you tape it like at 5:30 by the time the music goes on. So you come out of Letterman and in the fall or winter, you know, the sun is going down 5:30 or 6 o'clock, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're leaving Letterman, going toward the Hudson River. So that's west. I think it's on 53rd Street. And, you know, we're in a town car. I was in the front seat and Lou was in the back. And the sky was just golden. You know, it was that New York dusk. And all the brownstones along that street were kind of turning a beautiful color. And Lou just looked towards the Hudson and in the sunset, and I'll never forget, to himself, he was in the back seat alone, he just goes like, God, I love this city. And I just got shivers, because nobody loved New York more than Lou Reed, the city. Nobody. I never met anyone that was even close. He loved New York City. And to hear him say that to himself, it just, I mean, I still get shivers when I think about it now, just the amount of feeling he had in that one little sentence, talking to himself.
And, you know, the New York Public Library just opened up an exhibit of Lou Reed's papers and his archives. I think there's an archive release of material set to come out later this summer. Why do you think Lou Reed is relevant now? Why do you think people today are turning back to Lou Reed?
I think Lou is relevant now, especially about New York, because nobody ever even came close to portraying it and studying it and understanding it in their music than him. I mean, other bands came along, you might say Talking Heads or whoever, but nobody ever was even in the same universe as Lou in terms of devoting himself to the city he loved and lived in. And I think that will go on forever. I don't see how anybody else could ever top him. I mean, I saw recently where Dylan put his in Oklahoma, which, you know, I guess makes some sense, but for Lou Reed to be anywhere but New York, no, it couldn't be. It would be like a violation of philosophies.
Well, Bill, it's been a pleasure talking with you about some of your memories about Lou Reed and New York and the album New York. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us on Music and Time today.
Anytime. I'll look forward to hearing your show.
There's blacks with knives and whites with clubs fighting at Howl Beach. There's no such thing as human rights when you walk the New York streets. A cop was shot in the head by a 10-year-old kid named Boot in Central Park last week. The fathers and daughters lined up by the coffins by the statue of bigotry. Hey, you better hold on. Something happening here. You better hold on. Well, I'll meet you at Tompkins Square. The dopey sent a message to the cops last week and they shot him in the car where he sat. And Eleanor Bumpus and Michael Stewart must have appreciated that. There's a rampaging rage rising up like a plague of bloody vials washing up on the beach. It'll take more than the Angels or I and Mike Tyson to heal this bloody breach. Hey, hey, you better hold on. Or something's happening here. You better hold on. I'm gonna meet you in Tompkins Square. A junkie ran down a lady, a pregnant dancer. She'll never dance, but the baby was saved. He shot up some China white and nodded out at the wheel, and he doesn't remember a thing. They shot that old lady cause they thought she was a witness to a crime she didn't even see. Whose home is the home of the brave by the statue of bigotry? Hey, better hold on. Or something's happening here. You better hold on. There's a riot in Tompkins Square. You got a black 38 and a gravity knife. You still have to ride the train. There's the smelly essence of New York down there, but you ain't no Bernard Getz. There's no mafia lawyer to fight in your corner for that 15 minutes of fame. The have and have nots are bleeding in the tub. That's New York's future, not mine. Oh, you better hold on. Or something's happening here. You better hold on. If ever something's happening here.
You're listening to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormack. That was Hold On off Lou Reed's album New York, one of the songs on the album that really captures the literary texture, the urgency of what Lou Reed was describing on the streets of New York. Listening to that song, I can understand why Anthony DeCurtis, reviewing the album in Rolling Stone, called it an apocalyptic vision of the world's capital as a Boschian inferno. Now, there are like 24 references in that song alone that you could lose yourself in reading and thinking about. One I love is that line in the first chorus, "I'll meet you in Tompkins Square," which refers to a small but intense set of clashes that occurred between the NYPD and a group of squatters' rights advocates in the summer of 1988 over planned real estate developments near Tompkins Square Park. In another song on the album, The Incredible Halloween Parade, Reed grapples in a melancholy way with the effect that the AIDS epidemic had had on the city's gay community through the lens of the annual Halloween parade in Greenwich Village, where Reed had lived for quite some time. It all seems so New York and maybe esoteric, right? Not so fast. There's a line at the end of Hold On where Reed says, "The have and have-nots are bleeding in the tub. That's New York's future, not mine." But to me, that line is tongue-in-cheek. I think Reed was imploring his listeners to pay attention to what was going on in New York City. And that got me thinking, as we often do on this show, about other moments in history that mirror this one, where music coming out of New York City spoke to something much larger and much more relevant. As always, I'm curious what you think. Hit me up on social media and tell me what that makes you think of. Here's what I've got. "Gimme Gimme Shock Treatment" by the Ramones. Released on Leave Home in 1977, months before the Son of Sam killings captivated the country. Sure, not as literary as Lou Reed, but the Ramones' backbeat-driven punk seems to capture the pandemonium and madness that gripped the city that summer. But the greatest echo of this album's relevance is in our own time. Do you remember in the 2016 election during the Republican primary when Ted Cruz tried to attack Donald Trump by assailing his, quote, New York values? The idea was that Donald Trump, the paragon of New York excess, couldn't possibly understand real America. Well, since then, it seems like for the better part of the last 6 years, our country's national politics have reflected New York City, and not the good parts. Growing wealth disparities, the challenge of the pandemic, wilting social programs, questions over the meaning of law enforcement in our society. People might like to think of New York as something exceptional, a different place. But today, more than ever, it seems like the Big Apple might be the proving ground for the problems that we see writ large, and maybe the solutions. In a way, it seems like Lou Reed's depiction of a city divided upon itself in a fraying social safety net has become even more obviously relevant. So perhaps it's not totally coincidental that Lou Reed is now back in the public eye, with his archival papers recently coming online at the New York Public Library. They're also being featured in an exhibit at the New York Public Library for Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, titled Caught Between the Twisted Stars, a reference to a line you might remember hearing in Romeo Had Juliet. In a minute, you'll hear an awesome interview I did with Heather Lember, one of the archivists at NYPL, who was responsible for processing much of Lou Reed's collection for the library. But first, I've got to play a song that feels oh so relevant from this album, Sick of You, a song in which Reed plays with the absurdity that the 1980s had wrought in New York and the personal disaffection that seemed to have infected society at large. And if you don't believe me, just listen closely and you can hear Lou Reed name check both the Trumps and Rudy Giuliani.
I was up in the morning with the TV blaring, brush my teeth, sitting watching the news. All the beaches were closed, the ocean was a red sea, but there was no one there to part it in two. There was no fresh salad, cause there's hypers in the cabbage. Staten Island disappeared at noon. And they say the Midwest is in great distress, and NASA blew up the moon. The ozone layer has no ozone anymore, and you're gonna leave me for the guy next door. I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you. They arrested the mayor for an illegal favor, sold the Empire State to Japan. And Oliver North married William C. Corden, gave birth to a little Tehran. And the Ayatollah bought a nuclear warship. If he dies, he wants to go out in style. And there's nothing to eat that don't carry the stink of some human waste dumped in the Nile. Well, one thing is certainly true. No one here knows what to do. And I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you. Said there were 400 dead in some small town in Arkansas. Some whacked out trucker drove into a nuclear reactor, killed everybody he saw. Now he's on Morton Downey and he's glowing and shiny. Doctors say this is a medical advance. They say the bad makes the good and there's something to be learned in every human experience. Well, I know one thing that really is true. This here's a zoo and the keeper ain't you, and I'm sick of it. I'm sick of you. They ordained the Trumps and then he got the mumps and died being treated at Mount Sinai. And my best friend Bill died from a poison pill some wire doctor prescribed for stress. My arms and legs are shrunk, the food all has lumps. They discovered some animal no one's ever seen. It was an inside trader eating a rubber tire after running over Rudy Giuliani. They say the president's dead, no one can find his head. He's been missing now for weeks. But no one noticed it. He had seemed so fit. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of you. I'm so sick of you. Bye, bye, bye.
You're listening to Music in Time on WGXC, and right now I'm joined by Heather Lember, who is an archival processing coordinator at the New York Public Library, where she worked on Lou Reed's papers. Heather, I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself. What drew you to archival work and what you do at the NYPL?
Sure. I have to admit that being an archivist wasn't really on my radar until probably in my late 20s, and it was when there was a lot of press around the Riot Grrrl archive at NYU. And I was like, oh, I could work with stuff that I'm interested in. You know, that there's all these archives of musicians. And so I started looking into it, and that was kind of what got me into it. And then, you know, when being able to work at NYPL, where we have like a whole music division and, you know, all these collections by people that aren't just like authors or, you know, from like the 1800s, which is, I think, what my perception was of the field initially. So that was kind of what got me into it. And it worked out because I ended up working on Lou Reed's papers. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask, before the Lou Reed papers, what kinds of other projects had you worked on at NYPL so we can get a sense for how similar or different that project was?
So we actually, we work on collections from all of the research divisions. So I've worked on a little bit of everything. You know, it's manuscripts collections. I worked on dance collections, stuff for Schomburg. I worked on Harry Belafonte's papers recently. George Plimpton, who wrote for Sports Illustrated, so totally different types of materials. So it's a little bit of everything. And Lou Reed was definitely probably the highest profile, maybe the exception of the New York Review of Books was another really big one, but also totally different subject matter. And it's kind of just part of the job that we work on all sorts of topics.
Yeah. Do you have a memory of learning that NYPL had acquired the Lou Reed collection or that you would be processing it?
Sure. Yeah. It was not long after I started here in 2015. I'd been hearing like rumors that maybe the papers were coming here. And then they ended up showing up in 2017. And it was, you know, I was very interested in working on it. And I actually just asked our manager, like, can I work on these? And her response was, well, that was already the plan. Because I do have a background in music. So it just kind of made sense. And I think there wasn't really anyone that was particularly interested in working on something so high profile, because there's like a sort of people feel sometimes more pressure with something that they know a lot of people are going to look at. When it was delivered, I do remember that there was a lot of talk around that. I'm sure you've heard about the unopened demo that was found. It was actually delivered separately after it had been opened. So we were excited to be some of the first people to be able to hear that.
Yeah, were you one of the small circle? Were you present for the opening of that package?
I was not present. I've heard that they did film it. I haven't seen that video. I think it's probably, I think Don Fleming and Laurie Anderson, I know, were there. But we were, once it was open, they did send us the original package, which is in the exhibit at LPA right now. And then also the reel, which is actually in great condition because it had been unopened, unlistened to in this box since 1965.
What was the collection like, and what was your kind of day-to-day work, and how long did you work on it to process everything you had to process?
What was great about this collection is that it actually was well organized, because Lou Reed had archivists working for him during his lifetime. So everything was kind of like all of the audio materials already had, they had digitized a lot of them already, and included track lists, so we kind of knew what was there. Things were, his like office files were labeled folders. His photographs were mostly had like labels so we could tell what they were, which is not typical. so it was nice. I mean, it was a lot of material, but it was there was not too many mysteries in there about what it was. It was more like things that we know hadn't been heard by other people yet. So that was sort of the exciting part of it.
And how long did the work on, or your work on the papers take?
I think it was maybe a little under a year. A lot of that was actually because there is like 4 terabytes of hard drive content, because he was, and you probably know, like a really early adopter of like all recording technology. So he, you know, he started using Pro Tools really early. He was using Ableton, and there was terabytes of like his recordings. And also he was really prolific photographer. So all his photographs were in there as well. And so just having to go through that was one of the more time consuming parts of working on the papers.
I recognize as an archivist, it probably varies from project to project, but as you went into this, what interest did you have in Lou Reed? And then I'd like to ask, did you feel like you knew him or understood him in a different way after that year of working on his materials?
Yeah, so I am also a musician. So, and I have always been a fan of the Velvet Underground. So going into it, I was very interested. For me, particularly, it's interesting to see how other people write songs or come up with ideas. And so there's a lot of recordings of him kind of working out songs with his band, specifically later on, and also some rehearsals, Velvet Underground rehearsals. So to me, it was just interesting to hear the evolution of some of the songs. A lot of his songs, he literally, it seems like he just wrote from start to finish and recorded them. And he didn't hold on to any of, if he had drafts of lyrics, he didn't keep them. Like he kept, he just kept what he decided on, or maybe he just was like, the first draft is it. It's hard to know. But I thought that was interesting. I mean, he was really into like having the best guitar sound that he could. So it was interesting to see there's some information on like the pedals that he used and the different recording technologies that he was looking into. So that was also of interest to me. I think I went from being someone that was like very much just like into the Velvet Underground to really like knowing more about his solo career and getting into, Transformer is obvious, but all the things after that, it got more interested in. And I think actually the New York album specifically was kind of one that I had heard, but I definitely got a greater appreciation for it. Working with so closely with all of this, with all those materials.
Yeah, and that's the album we're talking about on the show today. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask, is there anything cool in the archive or anything unexpected related to the New York album?
Yeah, well, I know that there's, that, like I mentioned, listening to him work out songs, there is actually a number of rehearsal tapes in the collection from 1988, so before the album came out, where he's working with some of his band just on like the guitar riffs and like, and he's kind of singing, not quite singing the words yet, and sort of really working out the songs. And I also learned that the original title for Dirty Boulevard, he was calling it the Statue of Bigotry initially. I don't know when that changed, but on the early rehearsal tapes, that is sometimes what it's called. And then after the album came out, he would record the full album. It seemed like there's a number of recordings of that. Some of them actually featured Mo Tucker on drums, which was, I know she played on the album, which there's certain recordings where it seems like she actually was the drummer for the whole thing, which, you know, then they had a reunion a few years later. So that was maybe foreshadowing.
Is there an item in the collection that you feel a connection to, or that you think is particularly cool, kind of one you think about and take with you from your working on this?
Well, I mean, the demo is the obvious answer, but I think something that stood out to me was he seemed in the 60s and 70s, he seemed to always have a tape recorder with him. And he was just recording himself talking to everybody around him. And so there's some recordings, definitely from people in like the Warhol orbit, like just sitting around his house, like talking about astrology, like I know it was one of them. There's an interview he did in Australia, I think at the airport, which it's like pretty famous. It's like, I think it's on YouTube, but it's from 1975 and you see that he's holding a tape recorder in the interview. And we actually have the tape that turned out to be in that tape recorder, and you hear the whole interview, and then he keeps it running and he just complains about the interview for like a full car ride to his hotel. That's digitized. So if you're at the Performing Arts Library, you can listen to the full thing.
That leads to my next question, which is for our listeners. How can they interact with this collection? Where is it accessible? And then I know there's also an exhibit that's gone up at the, mm-hmm. at the New York Public Library for Performing Arts at Lincoln Center.
Well, what was unique about this collection is that so much of the content had been digitized ahead of time. So we were able to actually embed links into the finding aid, which is available online. And if you open the finding aid up at the Performing Arts Library, you can navigate to anything you're interested in listening to and just listen to it. And they all have track lists, so you can kind of go through and listen to what's interesting. And then some of that material is also featured in the exhibit you just mentioned, which is also at the Performing Arts Library. And I think it's up until his birthday, March 4th, 2023. And so I know they have listening stations there as well. And some of the video, which is not yet available through the finding aid.
Well, Heather, yes. It's been really fun talking about your work on the Lou Reed papers and hearing how Lou Reed influenced you as a musician yourself. So thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
Thank you.
So what to say to wrap up this episode of Music and Time? So much of Lou Reed's commentary on New York was obvious to listeners and reviewers at the time, and even highlighted by Lou Reed himself. It's Lou Reed at his most political, if not his most angry. But to me, what makes this album so special is the way he makes an argument at that precise moment in 1989 in a way that wasn't true in 1970 or 1967, that Lou Reed's New York is the beating heart of the United States. And that is what makes the album so relevant at another point in our national history when we seem again to be at a crossroads where the chaos of New York City life, questions of poverty, hand-wringing over crime waves, make us wonder, should we throw up our hands at the powerlessness that so many feel, or do we find a way to come together and solve it? And that is what makes this album so powerful, the call to action that Lou Reed believed the city could be expected to answer. As Lou Reed put it in another song on the album, there is no time. And I would play that song for you, but Lou was more right than he knew. There is no more time for our show. We are at the end of this episode of Music and Time. Thanks for joining me. Thanks to Bill Bentley and to Heather Lember for sharing their memories. I'll be back next month, take you on another sonic trip. Where and when will we travel? Stay tuned and find out. I'll see you then.